the heart and soul of Karl Marx. It's absolutely vital that we understand this, because there's an enormous amount of people lately getting all excited about socialism and communism. And I would have thought this had been dealt with a long time ago, but apparently it needs to be revisited. What is the heart and soul of Karl Marx? In his manifesto of 1848, Karl Marx wrote, "The theory of the communists may be summed up in a single sentence, abolition of private property. You reproach us with intending to do away with your property." Precisely so. That is just what we intend. To this end, he advocated abolition of property rights. How? By making property owners pay rents or rates to the state. How many people do you know who own their own house, reached retirement age, had to continue working, and had to even sell their house because they couldn't afford the rates and taxes, moved into some rental, struggling to survive, working into the 70s and 80s? That's private ownership of property being confiscated. So basically it is, oh, it's your house, but if you don't pay these rates and taxes and this and the other, we're going to take it away from you. Who owns your property? Number two, heavy progressive graduated income tax. Now, the Bible is clear, the rich should not give more and the poor should not give less. An equal taxation system is biblical. You can't have it, well, they pay 5%, they pay 10%, they pay 40%. This is not the way you sort out any tax at all, and it's designed to confiscate. In other words, a tax is a fine for doing good, like a fine is a tax for doing wrong. So a tax is a fine because you did things right. You penalize the productive and hardworking, and you reward those who were not. The way to crush the bourgeoisie is to grind them between the millstones of taxation and inflation. Few people understand that inflation is a hidden tax. In fact, the government steals more from you by inflation than they do even by taxation. Of course, corruption is another part of it too. Just think of how legislation has grown. And there's no way the legislators can even read all the pages, let alone consider study and research and think, is this a good idea? They are trying to deluge and tie up. I've had lawyers in America say, everyone breaks the law multiple times a week, because without even knowing it. If the government wants to go after anyone, they can find something that you've done against some regulation, because that's why they've got so many regulations that basically they've got everyone in some form of bondage. Number three, abolition of all rights of inheritance by taxing inheritance. This is a Karl Marx 1848 Marxist manifesto innovation to tax inheritance. Now, how can you tax inheritance? The person who's died has paid taxes on what he earned, and now, as the Bible says, a good man leaves inheritance for his children and his children's children. But now the state comes and effectively confiscates a whole lot of it away. And if you want a picture of how this works, just think of Downton Abbey, if you're aware of that drama, how the great houses of England, which provided so much stability and employment and accommodation for so many, got whittled away through taxation and rates and taxes and, of course, inheritance tax, death tax. Confiscation of the property of all immigrants and all rebels to the state. This is another Marxist manifesto, 1848, classic innovation, that they can confiscate people's property. Just think of what they did with the farmers in Zimbabwe. Or how a person wants to move from Berlin to Berlin, from East Berlin, the workers' paradise, to West Berlin. He gets shot in the back the day after his 18th birthday. There's Peter Fetcher, shot in the back by his own police, Vopos, Volkspolizei, for the crime of wanting to move from one part of his city to another. Number five, centralization of credit in banks of the state by means of a national bank with an exclusive monopoly on money supply. It used to be that private banks issued paper money, which was not money, it was a promissory note, for gold or silver in the bank. And so you had different banks, and of course some banks are more reliable than others and so on. But having a state bank, which actually isn't even owned by the state, it's owned by some multinational Rothschild entity. And in this way, well, to quote from Stephen Mitford Goodson, who once was director of the Southern Reserve Bank, the Southern Reserve Bank is not South African, it has no reserves, and it's not a bank. Just like the Federal Reserve in America, it's not federal, it has no reserves, and it's not a bank. And he is the whistleblower who blew the whistle on what was going on in the South African Reserve Bank. And then he followed it up by writing a history of central banking and the enslavement of mankind. Very interesting. I had never, as someone fascinated with history, considered the economics of wars, for example. Stephen Goodson said all the wars of the 20th century are bankers' wars. What? All of them? And in fact, you've got to read his books to believe just how insidious is the role of the Rothschilds and the bankers and all the rest. Number six, centralization of the means of communication and transport in the hands of the state. Think telecom, Transnet, that sort of thing. Number seven, factories and instruments of production are to be owned by the state. Wilderness areas are to be nationalized by the state because nobody cares about business and wildlife more than the government, obviously. In fact, nobody cares about your children more than the government either. They know what's best for your children better than the parents do. So it's all about control. Number eight, equal obligation of all to be put to work by the state. Just think of salt mines in Siberia and 50 million volunteers that were just forcibly at point of gun made to move hundreds of millions of tons of earth. Number nine is establishment of industrial armies, especially for agriculture. And if you want to know how that worked, consider how they combined agriculture with manufacturing industries, gradually abolishing all distinction between town and country by a more equitable distribution of the populace over the whole country. Dekulakization was the word. Today they call it land reform or expropriation, not compensation. In Russia it was dekulakization. You want to know how that works? Got to see the drama Bitter Harvest. It's in our library. Or read Black Book of Communism, which is all from their own archives. 900-page doorstop. You can drop it in a socialist's foot. He will limp. All documentation from their own archives. Or Death by Government by Professor Rummel. How he documents that the greatest threat to life has not been wars. It hasn't been crime. It's been governments killing their own people in the 20th century, and he documents well over 169 million killed by communist governments alone, just in the 20th century alone. Number 11, free and compulsory education, read indoctrination, for all children in state schools. This is an 1848 Marxist manifesto innovation. Up till then, schools were run by parents, churches, missions, voluntary societies. The state had nothing to do with education, but by 1848, the Marxists, the atheists, the revolutionaries recognized they'd lost the battle. The Christians were educating the whole world, so they had to hijack the schools, hijack education. The idea that teachers must be trained by the state, licensed by the state, and the textbooks provided by the state is a completely 1848 Communist Manifesto innovation. To understand this better, you need to see the Agenda movies. Excellent movies, put together by Curtis Bauer. Agenda and Agenda 2. I personally prefer Agenda 2 because it puts in hope for the future. And it's not just exposing the bad, it's giving the way forward. But the two of them, excellent insight into especially the role of communism running education and the economy. In 1959, Nikita Khrushchev, dictator of the Soviet Union, said to the Americans, "Your children's children will live under communism. You Americans are so gullible. No, you won't accept communism outright. But we'll keep feeding you small doses of socialism until you will finally wake up and find that you already have communism. We won't have to fight you. We'll so weaken your economy until you fall like overripe fruit into our hands." Was he over-optimistic? What was Obama's policies? What was Hillary Clinton's? Karl Marx wrote, "The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness for mankind is a requisite for their real happiness." In the Communist Manifesto, 1848, Karl Marx wrote, "Communism abolishes eternal truths. It abolishes all religion and all morality." This is the heart and soul of Marxism. Karl Marx wrote, "I wish to avenge myself against the one who rules above. I shall build my throne high overhead. Cold, tremendous shall its summit be, for its bulwark, superstitious dread, for its marshal, blackest agony." Karl Marx wrote to his father, "New gods will have to be installed." And they have installed new gods. You just think how the Soviet Union made a pyramid-like temple based on Egyptian House of the Dead for the founder of communism in the Soviet Union, Vladimir Lenin. And on top is where they would have the, here in this balcony, above the bones of Lenin, the whole Politburo of the Soviet Union would gather for Red Square, March Past, May Day, 1st of May, Human Sacrifice Day in the Satanic calendar. And underneath there's, well, they say it's Karl Marx, but it's mostly plaster of Paris and all that because, you know, his ears fell off, nose fell off, fingers fell off. They didn't do a very good job of embalming him originally. But nevertheless, there's no doubt that Karl Marx is dead. In his drama, Olenim, and notice that's Emmanuel sort of backwards, Olenim, that's one of his poems. He wrote, "The hellish vapors rise and fill the brain, till I go mad, and my heart is utterly changed. See the sword, the prince of darkness sold it to me. For me beats the time and gives the signs. Ever more boldly I play the dance of death." Marx loved to quote the words of Faust, "Everything in existence is worth being destroyed. If there is a something which devours, I'll leap within it. Though I bring the world to ruins, the world which bulks between me and the abyss, I shall smash to pieces with my enduring curses." This sounds like a man more than demon-possessed. It sounds like a man who's possessed by Satan himself, not just some lower-level demon. "Without violence," Marx said, "nothing is ever accomplished in history. Violence is the midwife," he said. And just think of what the communists did to Rhodesia, cutting off this poor man's ears and lips because he didn't listen to the commissar and he spoke against Mugabe. This woman is forced to eat her lips that were cut off and cook and eat them because she had offended the commissars, what she said. Murdering missionaries, murdering Madibili, mostly Christians, shooting village headmen or pastors, bayoneting people in the back, murdering missionaries, pacifist Pentecostal missionaries from England, the Elam missionaries. "Without violence, nothing is accomplished on earth." This is the writing of Karl Marx. "Thus heaven I forfeited, I know it full well. My soul, once true to God, is chosen for hell." Now, you may be surprised to know that although he is born into a Jewish family, his father converted when he was age 6 for business purposes to Christianity, and he was catechized as a Lutheran. And to read some of Karl Marx's works, and this has been done in one of the doctoral theses by Professor Francis Nigel Lee, on some of the writings of Karl Marx as a youngster, it sounds like a born-again Christian. Now, obviously, he couldn't have been truly regenerate, but the man understood the gospel, and he turned against Christ. And by age 18, interestingly, although his father converted formally to Christianity when he was 6, his mother never did. His mother stayed steadfastly, although they were Jewish, her mother was actually an atheist. And Karl Marx went way past her. He became a Satanist. In his poem, Human Pride, Marx wrote, "With disdain I will throw my gauntlet full in the face of the world and see the collapse of this pygmy giant, whose fall will not stifle my ardor. Then I will wander, godlike and victorious, through the ruins of the world, and giving my words an act of force, I will feel equal to the Creator." Now notice here, a picture of Marxism striding amongst the masses of people in the streets with the red banner, taller than the Orthodox Church steeple. That's the point, the symbolism here. This is a communist artistry from the 1920s. This is their whole mentality, to overwhelm the church. Karl Marx's good friend, best friend actually, Friedrich Engels wrote, "Karl Marx is a monster possessed by 10,000 devils." Now this wasn't criticism, this was a compliment from someone who knew and loved him. He's a monster possessed by 10,000 devils. This is like, you know, something you'd put in the back of your book, endorsement. That's the kind of attitude of Karl Marx and his friend Friedrich Engels. Robert Paine, a friend of Karl Marx, wrote that Karl Marx had the devil's view of the world and the devil's malignity, malice. Sometimes he seemed to know he was accomplishing the works of evil. Again, that's what his friend wrote. Karl Marx wrote he wanted to hurl gigantic curses on mankind. Marx quoted positively from Paris Communard Florence, who declared, "Our enemy is God." Hatred of God is the beginning of wisdom. Now, where's he got that phrase from? The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, we read in Proverbs. But he's changing around to hatred of God is the beginning of wisdom. This is very satanic. Satanism likes to invert everything. They reverse everything, like Olenim, taking a manual and reversing it. Karl Marx never ran a company. He never held political office. He wasn't elected to anything. He never oversaw any accounts. He never even held a job, any job. He wasn't a worker. He was supported throughout his life by his friend, Friedrich Engels, the son of a wealthy factory owner, and by people's inheritance that he received. In fact, there's letters in existence where he shouted with joy to hear that some aunt had died because he had received a whole lot of money and that sort of thing. So this man had absolutely no business or work experience, but he was considered by many to be the greatest social, political, economic philosopher of all time. And many of our universities, including up on the hill here, Sodom on the hillside, UCT, University of Communist Terrorism, they seem to think that Karl Marx is a great economist. All application of his theories have ended in abject failure, catastrophic failure, actually. And Karl Marx's family life was a disaster. He had 7 children by his wife, Jenny, another by his housemaid, Helen Demuth. Now, he shacked up with his wife for many years before he got formally married, and that was for some reason politically considered expedient. So he had 8 children. 3 of Karl Marx's 8 children starved to death. Karl Marx never lacked money for printing political posts and so on, but his children lacked food. 5 of his children died prematurely. One of his daughters, Eleanor, married Edward Aveling, a Satanist, known for his blasphemous lectures on the wickedness of God and for his poem to Satan. She became a major mover in the feminist movement and an open Satanist, Eleanor Aveling. 2 of Karl Marx's daughters committed suicide, and his wife also committed suicide. He must have been a bundle of laughs to live with. And can you imagine? How many people do you know who've had their wife and 2 children commit suicide? And 3 die of starvation. Why is this evil man honored and worshipped on a university campus? Here's Karl Marx and his friend Friedrich Engels. And by the way, they did wife swapping and orgies, and they were openly immoral all over the place. And his wife had no problem with the fact that he is sleeping with the domestic and things like that. They were all, I mean, I don't know what you think, but the whole bunch of these are completely and utterly demon-possessed. Jenny Carolina and Jenny Laura Marx. By the way, one of the Marx daughters is buried in Cape Town. She married Jutta, who provided most of the textbooks for universities for many, many, many decades. And he also Karl Marx wrote a regular column for a Cape Town newspaper that doesn't exist anymore. But so there's a Cape Town link to this man. By the way, South Africa's got the 2nd oldest communist party in the world. Southern Communist Party is the 2nd oldest in the world. Why? Well, gold, diamonds, you know. The Communist Party really got started out of the Kimberley diamond fields. Karl and Jenny Marx. I mean, these are really evil people. Laura Marx, Eleanor Marx, she really took his work on. She was avid Marxist. So here she is. Eleanor tutored the leaders of the workers' movement, and she laid the foundations of the feminist movement. Karl Marx wrote he didn't love anyone, that he is entirely comfortable with hatred. He referred to the Slavic people, like Russians, as ethnic trash and prophesied that the very name will vanish, which is incredibly intriguing considering that it's the Slavic people who are singing his praises and building him statues and monuments and having his portrait in all their homes and schools and churches even. And quite extraordinary. He regarded the very people who worshipped him as ethnic trash. He dismissed Mexicans as lazy, although the Communist Party in Mexico is doing quite well. And Negroes, he said, were frozen at prehistoric levels who would never contribute anything worthwhile to society. Which makes it extraordinary. Why are there any black communists in Africa who call themselves Marxists, like For example, you can think of Mengistu and Mandela and Ramaphosa and Mbeki, Mugabe, and Marxists. But Marx despised them, like he despised the Russians and the Slavic people of Eastern Europe. In the manifesto, Karl Marx wrote, "We destroy the most hallowed oblations when we replace home education with social education," by which he meant state education run by the Communist Party. Home education is the enemy of Marxism. Marx's dedicated disciple Vladimir Lenin declared, "Atheism is the natural and inseparable part of communism. We must hate. Hatred is the basis of communism." Leon Trotsky, whose correct name was Leonard Bronstein, he's a Russian Jew who had fled to America to escape from the Tsar's police, and he was living in the Bronx when the Bolshevik Revolution erupted. And so he gathered around a whole lot of other Jewish communists in the Bronx, and they went over and they started the Cheka, the Red Army, and they slaughtered Christians in Russia, which is why Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, to call it the Russian Revolution is an insult to the Russian victims. It wasn't a Russian revolution. It was a Bolshevik revolution. It was an anti-Russian revolution. And I must say, I am very sorry that for years I spoke about the Russian revolution, because that's not accurate. It's the Bolshevik revolution. It was the anti-Russian revolution. And here's the pile of corpses under. And of course, you see the broken cross at the top of this dome here, and the Communist Party's flags flying from the spires of what used to be churches. It's all very symbolic. Beheading Christians in China, shooting them in the back. And to this day, communism in China has not changed. Under Vladimir Lenin, one of the slogans of the Soviet Union was, "We fight against God to snatch believers from him." And there's many books documenting tortured for Christ, the Christians in Russia, martyred. A prominent slogan of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was, "Let us drive out the capitalists from the earth and God from heaven." That's just their slogan. And you can see the new socialist man and woman with a hammer, the sickle. The sickle represents the peasants, the farm workers, and the hammer represents the workers. Now, the workers always refers to urban workers, industrial workers, and the peasants always refers to the agricultural workers. And to them, they always disliked the peasants, because the peasants were like kulaks. They were conservative, they were Christians, they were resistant to communism. Their main power base was with the hammer. And the sickle represents the farmers, but they wanted to bring the farmers under. But they had to kill millions of them and ship millions more, especially from Ukraine, the breadbasket of Europe, off to Siberia, to try and get the peasants, the farm workers, to work with the workers. They want them to, when they speak about the workers, they're talking about urban industrial factory workers. When they refer to the peasants or the kulaks, they're referring to the farmers. And this is the way it's worked from the beginning. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the greatest Russian author, Nobel Literature Award winner of the 20th century, Alexander Solzhenitsyn declared, "The world has never before known a godlessness as organized, militarized, and tallaciously malevolent as that preached by Marxism. Within the philosophical system of Marx and Lenin, and at the heart of their psychology, hatred of God is the principal driving force, more fundamental than all their political and economic pretensions." Now, if you taught in university that the heart and soul of Marxism is economic determinism, dialectical materialism, that's not the heart. Not according to a man who lived under communism for most of his life. Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, "Hatred of God is their principal driving force. It's far more fundamental than all their political and economic pretensions." Those are pretensions. They've got slogans, but at the heart, far more important than the slogans, is the hatred of God. Militant atheism is not merely incidental or marginal to communist policy. It is not a side effect, but the central pivot. To achieve its diabolical ends, communism needs to control a population devoid of religious and national feeling, and this entails the destruction of faith and nationhood. Communists proclaim both of these objectives openly, and just as openly, they put them into practice. That is a quote all from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And by the way, he gave this speech with this quote at Buckingham Palace before Queen Elizabeth II, back when he was still popular, when he had just come out of Russia. Later, Alexander Solzhenitsyn committed the unforgivable sin, and after that, you never heard from him again in public. And many people would have thought that he had died, but he hadn't. And even when the Berlin Wall came down, the Soviet Union collapsed, no press were quoting from Solzhenitsyn. Why were they ignoring the greatest Russian authority of the 20th century? He committed the unforgivable sin. What did he say? In a speech in Harvard, 1978, Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, "Behind the Iron Curtain, in our Eastern countries, our press speaks with one voice. All the media speaks with one voice. But we're not surprised because we have a one-party political dictatorship and they own the press, so we understand the media speaks with one voice behind the Iron Curtain. But now I'm in the West, the free democratic West. In fact, he's in Harvard University at the moment he made the speech. And your media also speaks with one voice. And same voice I heard behind the Iron Curtain. Who controls the media in the West?" And at that point, it's like he had vaporized, disappeared. He went down the memory hole. He became an unperson, to use 1984 George Orwell terminology, and they just ignored him from then on. But Solzhenitsyn knew what he's talking about. He spent how many years in the concentration camps? Karl Marx said, "Democracy is the road to socialism." And socialism has proven to be the pathway to ruin. I should add an interesting quote from Karl Marx. Karl Marx said, "I'm an atheist, but the time will come when communists will not identify themselves as atheists because the very concept of God will not even be known. And so there won't be any point to deny theism because there won't be any knowledge of theism. And so the goal is not just to resist God, but to get to the point where the next generation doesn't even know of the concept of God." Mice die in mouse traps because they do not understand why the cheese is free. It's the same thing with socialism. Free education, free houses, free. Why is it free? Of course, somebody's got to pay for it. But it's for the same reason that the cheese in a mouse trap is free. Vladimir Lenin, 1921, said, "How to destroy the West, corrupt the young, get them away from religion, encourage the interest in sex, make them superficial by focusing the interest in sports, sensual entertainments, and trivialities. Always preach true democracies, but seize power as fast and as ruthlessly as possible. Encourage government extravagance. Destroy its credit. Produce fear with rising prices, inflation, and general discontent. Encourage disorders. Foster a lenient attitude towards disorders. Riots. Call rioters protesters. Call it unrest while they're burning and looting and everything. By specious argument, cause the breakdown of the old moral virtues, honesty, sobriety, and self-restraint. Cause registration of firearms to leave the population defenseless." These are just some of the summary. There's a book written by Cleon Skousen, who had been, I think, in the FBI studying communism. He wrote the book The Naked Communist, and in it he catalogued 45 different goals of communism. And it included things like do away with loyalty oaths, capture one or two or both of the political parties in the United States, use technical decisions of the courts to weaken basic institutions by claiming their activities violate civil rights, gain control of schools, use schools as transmission belts for socialism and current communist propaganda, soften the curriculum, get hold of teachers' associations, or the communist parties controlled the teachers' associations for a long time, teachers' unions, put the party line in textbooks, gain control of all student newspapers, use student riots to foment public protest against programs or organizations that are under communist attack, infiltrate the press, gain control of book review assignments, editorial policy, of course, film reviews. If it's a good film, if it's filthy, vile, and vulgar, outstanding, Oscar award-winning material, all right-thinking people should, and so on. Gain control of key positions in radio, TV, and motion pictures. In fact, the Communist Party was the only party in town in Hollywood, as they said, literally. They back in 1921, targeted Hollywood and California as to become the new church, the new religion of the world. Discredit the local culture by degrading all forms of artistic expression. Eliminate all good sculpture from parks and buildings. Substitute shapeless, awkward, and meaningless forms. This is part of communist agenda. Eliminate all laws governing obscenity by calling them censorship and a violation of free speech and free press. Break down cultural standards of morality by promoting pornography and obscenity in books, magazines, motion pictures, radio, TV, and plays. This is the Gramsci strategy, which we'll get to just now. Present homosexuality, degeneracy, and promiscuity as normal, natural, and healthy. Infiltrate churches. Replace revealed religion with social religion. Discredit the Bible. Emphasize the need for intellectual maturity, which does not need a religious crutch. Is this not in our theological cemeteries right now? Eliminate prayer or any phase of religious expression in schools on grounds that violates the principle of separation of church and state. Discredit the founding fathers of the nation. Present them as selfish aristocrats who had no concern for the common man. Belittle all forms of the local culture. Discourage teaching on history on the grounds it's only a minor part of the big picture. Give more emphasis to, and they have all their different nonsense. Support any socialist movement to give centralized control over any part of culture, education, social agencies, welfare programs, mental health clinics, and churches. Central control. Eliminate all laws or procedures which interfere with the operation of the communist apparatus. And it carries on and on. Here's number 40. Discredit the family as an institution. Encourage promiscuity and easy divorce. This is all part of the Marxist agenda, Communist Party USA. Emphasize the need to raise children away from the negative influence of parents. Attribute prejudices, mental blocks, and retarding of children to the suppressive influence of parents. Nobody cares about your children more than the state. You don't know what's best for your children. The state does. Overthrow all colonial governments before the native populations are ready for self-government, and so on. These are part of the 45 actual goals of communism as documented in the Naked Communist by Leon Skousen. And you'll notice Ronald Reagan endorsed the book, said, "You will be alarmed. You will be glad that you read Leon Skousen." And Dr. Ben Carson said, "Read The Naked Communist and you'll understand why the progressive plans always fail." And this is The Naked Communist, one of the key books. It's in our library and so on here too. And so here we are at the southern tip of Africa. How does this affect us? Well, throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s, and now into 2019, so much of this is aflame with socialism, communism, and the Marxist agenda. Look at Zimbabwe. I mean, while everyone's been praising Robert Mugabe, including the Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation in Britain, the BBC, and Sly Magazine, and Useless News and World Report, and the Clinton News Network, this is a maternity ward in Harare. Bring your own mat. Literally. Mugabe spent more money on his personal suite in Singapore for the last 4 months of his life, over 12 million rand. But that's what kind of medicines and surgeries. That's just the suite, just the cost of the suite. In 4 months, then the entire budget of the eastern province of Manicaland in Zimbabwe. We've been to the eastern province of Manicaland to revive the provincial hospital which had collapsed because they had no medicines, they had nothing. The whole hospital had closed, effectively, and our little mission with a few truckloads of medicines and food managed to open up their provincial hospital in Matari, which didn't even have a budget at all for the whole year. But Mugabe could pour millions into his own medical care. This is the gardens of one of the provincial hospitals in Zimbabwe. It used to be a magnificent garden when it was Rhodesia, but this is what it's like now. No medicines, no food. Well, UN World Food Summit, old Mugabe's biting into an Africa-sized steak. Well, Mugabe has now gone to his eternal reward. And the news this week is that all 2 million people in Harare have no water, no water coming through the taps. This is what people spend most of the day doing, queuing with buckets to get some water. And they've often got to wait for half an hour before the next bucket is filled because the well's so dry. And you can see all the means of trying to get the food, get the water. This is Zimbabwe, the legacy of Mugabe. And what does the Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation have to say? Robert Mugabe improved healthcare and education for Zimbabweans. Can you imagine? Why do we have such lack of integrity in the media today? This is what people are reduced to in Zimbabwe under Mugabe. And yet you have got people praising Mugabe today while his people live in a ruined, wrecked country. Thabo Mbeki said at the Durban ANC-organized memorial service for Mugabe, not one person in Zimbabwe wanted Mugabe removed from power. Who are those millions dancing in the street? Mnangagwa is praising Mugabe. You're thinking, then why did you overthrow him 2 years ago if he's such a great, wonderful liberator? The lies. This is what African debt relief looks like. This is actually how it works, you know. He thinks he's got a bucket. Actually, it's just a funnel. They promise them freedom while they themselves are slaves of depravity. 2 Peter 2 verse 19 can be written across every socialist and communist agenda and party. Atheism is like a fish denying the existence of water. Atheism is a dead-end street. Just take Cyril Ramaphosa, who people are praising. I don't know how many people. We've got Christians in South Africa like Louise Swart of the ACDP. After Cyril Ramaphosa had made his expropriation without compensation speech, our prayers have been answered. We are saved. At last, a president to be proud of. Now we can start to rebuild a country. He said this after his speech. We're going to expropriate farms from whites without compensation. What are these people thinking? What are they doing? When he was put in charge of solving Eskom, it went bankrupt. When he was put in charge of SABC, it went bankrupt. South African Airways, bankrupt. Petro SA, bankrupt. Danel, bankrupt. Post Office, totally bankrupt. Prasa, bankrupt. But he says nationalizing the South Reserve Bank will reaffirm South Africa's sovereignty, just like nationalizing the farms. This man has got to be one of the worst presidents this country's ever had. And I would have said Mbeki was the worst, but Cyril's working out to be much worse. And for somebody who thinks that Zuma was the worst ANC president, he's the least worst. He really was the least worst. I don't know, the media made a big thing about him, but the fact is, I think a lot of it was because he's Zulu, but Mandela is the one who closed down the nurses' training colleges, the teachers' training colleges, gutted the most efficient civil service in the country, gutted the army and the police, and legalized abortion, pornography, and put homosexual rights into the Constitution, in the Constitution, not just the laws. Mbeki is the one who went after schools, guns, Christian radio stations, closed 11 Christian radio stations. You know, Zuma, actually, we had more freedom of speech and we had more freedom of movement. We had more freedom for the gospel under Zuma than we had under any of the other ANC presidents. Cyril Ramaphosa might work out to be even worse than Mbeki, who up till now would have said was our worst president. And people who don't understand it have not been paying attention. Corruption is killing us. Governments create wealth the same way ticks create blood. Polyticks. Polymany ticks, blood-sucking parasites. Polyticks, many blood-sucking parasites. And you just think of where the tick gets his blood from. From his host. And maybe one tick won't kill you, but sure make you sick. But a whole lot of ticks can kill anyone. An ex-communist who gave us an insight to how communists think was George Orwell. George Orwell actually was, while a dedicated communist, visited Russia, the workers' paradise, in 1930s and saw how Uncle Joe Stalin's wonderful workers' paradise was operating. And he came back and he became an anti-communist. And he wrote Animal Farm. You know, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. And then he wrote the much darker 1984. He wrote this in 1948. And he saw the world going in such a bad way because the West had just saved the Soviet Union. And he could just see the influence of the Second World War having salvaged the Soviet Union from imminent defeat and having removed the two greatest opponents of communism, Japan in Asia and Germany in Europe. He saw communism's going to sweep over so much more of the world, which it has infested, because you cannot glamorize the Second World War as though the good guys won without the consequence being that you won't see how life has not gotten better since 1939. Things have gotten worse, vastly worse, especially for us in Africa. And so George Orwell's insights are absolutely tremendous, and his insights into everything from going down the memory hole, unpersoning things, and so on. Karl Marx declared the first battlefield is a rewriting of history. And you see this in George Orwell's 1984. Winston Smith, what's his job? Rewriting history to work out anyone who's no longer in good graces with the Communist Party. First battlefield, rewriting history. This is why I've devoted so much of my life to writing history books, to try and rectify the lies of these people. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was a loyal Russian soldier, but in a private letter he expressed some criticism of some of what Stalin's policies were doing. He ended up for years, was it 14 years, in concentration camps in Siberia. He's the one who gave the word gulag to the world. He wrote The Gulag Archipelago and One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich and a whole lot of other great books, Cancer Ward. His books are today essential required reading textbooks in Russia by order of Vladimir Putin, four of his top books, including these. And Alexander Solzhenitsyn's incisive analysis and insights to communism are so valuable, I'm going to use a lot of his quotes here. Now, if you can just ignore these silly girls in the foreground, and what's on the wall? There's a British classroom. Nelson Mandela, something against George Bush, this Marxist, Leninist, mass-murdering, dirty, unwashed communist thug Che Guevara, who said if Jesus Christ was alive today, I'd squish him like a bug. Well, Jesus Christ is alive today, and he's squishing this guy like a bug. And Martin Luther King. What do these have to do with education? Nothing. They've got everything to do with indoctrination propaganda there. Here's the quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. The generation are coming out of Western schools as unable to distinguish good from bad. Even those words are unacceptable. The result is impaired thinking ability. No jokes. The average person, they can't even think, let alone discern right from wrong. It's a universal law. Intolerance is the first sign of an inadequate education. An ill-educated person behaves with arrogant impatience, whereas truly profound education breeds humility. We've got to recognize that we can be wrong on many things. And when we find ourselves arrogant and proud and treating people with disrespect, you immediately know that what you've got is poor education. Marxists aim to demoralize their targeted victims by psychological warfare, psyops. Now, in a sense, it's always been around, but it's just getting more sophisticated. You think in the old days, like especially in the, if you read The Washing of the Spears, how Shaka rose and built the Zulu nation, they'd have the praise singers going out there, and before battle, they'd face one another, and each side was singing, and sort of like in America, don't they have these, what do they call them, to get people excited before the match, sports people? Cheerleaders. So they have the cheerleaders for each side, getting the people worked up and so on. And the goal is to build up the morale of your side and break down the morale of the other side. Understandable. So everyone's done this. But they've moved into a whole new range of psyops today. They use guilt manipulation. This is why rewriting history is so important. Hollywood has become phenomenally effective at putting the father in a bad light. Put the patriarchy, as I said, the father is the most hated villain, the most despised villain in Hollywood. Vilifying the victims and victimizing the villains. Some of the victims are always the villains. And the villains, the way they've done it, the villains are made out to be victims and the victims are made out to be villains. This is just the whole new blame game. They have a politics of guilt and pity which seeks to undermine Christianity and nationalism. Now, one of Christianity's strengths, which is humility and being self-critical, the enemy is able to take that and turn it against us. So that we will question ourselves and we'll be humble and we'll back off and we'll say sorry. You know, the last thing you want to ever do to a communist or guilt manipulator is say, I'm sorry. As long as I've been a Christian, which is 42 years, I've heard Afrikaans, Dutch Reformed, Germanese standing up at public events apologizing for apartheid. Do you think it's done any good? No, it's made it worse. Because it's like when the wolves and the hyenas taste blood, they just want more. It never, ever worked. We've got to repent before God. We've got nothing to apologize to Marxist, mass-murdering, backstabbing scum for. Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, in our country, the Soviet Union, the lie has become not just a moral category, but a pillar of the state. The state's built on lies. Well, is South Africa not built on lies right now? Under the duties required in the Ninth Command, the Westminster Larger Catechism lists the duty of preserving and promoting the truth, the duty to stand for the truth and to do so from the heart, the duty to speak the truth and only the truth in matters of judgment and justice, the duty to speak the truth at all times, the duty to study and practice everything true, noble, lovely, and of good report, which is what we try to devote most of the Reformation Society to. Under sins forbidden in the Ninth Command, the Westminster Standards includes the sin of giving false evidence, the sin of lying, the sin of concealing the truth, the sin of misconstruing intentions, the sin of exaggerating minor faults, and the sin of perverting the truth to a wrong meaning. Misconstruing intentions. You can say what you saw. You can say what you felt. You can say what happened, but you cannot attribute the other person's motives. You don't know the other person's motives, but somehow they do. They've now invented the hate crime. And if you disagree with the communists at any point, you're guilty of hate speech. Truth is truth, even if no one believes it. And a lie is a lie, even if everyone believes it. Alexander Solzhenitsyn quotes, "The simple truth of a courageous individual is not to take part in the lie. One word of truth outweighs the world. You can resolve to live your life with integrity. Let your credo be this. Let the lie come into the world. Let it even triumph. But not through me. I will not advance or contribute to the lie. I will not accede to the lie. I'm not going to play their game." So truth is now called the new hate speech. George Orwell wrote in 1984, "In a time of deceit, telling the truth becomes a revolutionary act." And so, in a sense, we're revolutionaries because we're trying to proclaim the truth of God's word and the truth of God's world. So how do they succeed? Through intimidation, through politically correct censorship and intimidation. You just take one of the most vicious fascist groups on the planet are called Antifa or anti-fascist. They are a bunch of fascists. They give no freedom. They're the most intolerant group in the world, beating people up in the name of tolerance. And of course, there's cyberbullying. The moment you try to do anything sensible, you get people attacking you. I mean, I remember Daniela a few years ago took a We Love God's Animals post of a soldier in the Second World War giving something to drink to a little kitten sitting on his lap. And next thing, she was attacked, the most vicious attacks on all sorts of friends from college and so on, that she's promoting Nazism because the soldier's wearing a German uniform. Think, it's a private soldier, a rifleman. He's got no rank. I don't see any armbands. I see no political symbols. How do you know he's a Nazi? I mean, there's only about 5% of the population actually members of the political party in any country at any time. And now one soldier in a time of brutality and starvation and bombing of cities, and he's sharing some milk out of his canteen with a kitten in the middle of a war. It's a lovely picture. She shares it with a verse, "A good man is kind to his animals and the wicked are cruel to theirs." The attacks on Daniela were so brutal. And I got involved in this. And I mean, these mindless idiots, the cyber bullies, just ranting and raving and screaming and shouting and all caps and exclamation marks and red letters and bolds and unbelievable. So much so that, I mean, literally, my daughter was in tears and deleted the post because of cyberbullying. This is the kind of rubbish that's out there. They won't let you portray a normal human being as a decent person because they have demonized an entire nation. And then you get the cry bullies, attack of the cry bullies. Notice they're pampered. Demanding social justice and I'll hold my breath for justice. And I think right now we've got one of these girls from Sweden who's running around screaming, "How dare you," and so on. So it's great. You brainwash some kid to go out there. This is real child abuse. And, your safe space in universities and burn reason, burn the constitution, burn logic, burn the curriculum. And these are the liberals. Trumping on people saying, "So sorry." It doesn't matter. The cry bullies are the ones that we've now got. We've now got not just cry babies, but we've got cry bullies. This, unfortunately, is the way our universities have gotten. And I'm sorry to say, it seemed to start up at University of Cape Town campus. Started in 2015 with the Rhodes Must Fall. I mean, literally January 2015, I stood at UCT campus waiting for the ACA trailer to come up so that we could get a picture up Jemmy steps of our pro-life trailer and Jemison Hall and Devil's Peak. And so while we're waiting for the trailer to get there, I'm standing by the statue of Cecil Rhodes, the founder of the universe, and said, people of Pop, do you know whose statue this is? No idea. University lecturers come past. No idea. Not one person. And while I was waiting there for maybe 20 minutes, I was walking past, nobody knew whose statue this was. Less than a month later, nobody could study at the campus. They were so traumatized because of that statue. You know, and next thing in America, they picked this up. I didn't know. We set the trend for America too. And they had to bring down Confederate monuments of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. Marxists seem to mobilize hysterical, spiteful, vindictive opposition to science or dissent. You know how it works. I mean, it starts with a baby. If the baby doesn't get his way, screams and throws a tantrum. They want to buy this and so on. Let's humiliate mommy in the shop by flinging themselves backwards, lying on the floor, screaming and so on. So after a while, they'll give them what they want. Now they know it works and they're going to do it more. So the worst thing you can do is give in to that kind of bullying, cry bullying. But the way it is like this silly little girl who's being groomed by the Marxists to advance their climate change agenda to shout out, how dare you? And how dare she talk to her elders like that? You know, and yet they're all applauding this, just abusing some youngster who's been groomed in order to intimidate people. Into, you can't, if you speak against her agenda with facts on, now you're guilty of child abuse. But actually, it's child abuse to put a child up there to advance a political agenda. You should be able to question a person's thing without having your motives impinged. Now, do you know what gaslighting is? Gaslighting is a form of psychological abuse used by narcissists in order to instill in their victims an extreme sense of anxiety and confusion to the point where they no longer trust their own memory, their own perception, their own judgment. The techniques used in gaslighting by the narcissist are similar to those used in brainwashing, interrogation and torture. They've been used in psychological warfare and by intelligence operatives, law enforcement for years. And of course, you make a Stockholm syndrome. For example, you get an abused wife who makes excuse for husband. No, I fell down the stairs. No, I walked into a lamppost and that sort of thing. The term gaslighting comes from a famous Ingrid Bergman movie called Gaslight. In fact, there's even a dictionary now, gaslighting. And what happens is this lovely heiress is charmed into marriage by a man who's actually the murderer of her relative in order to get into her home to find valuable things, that jewels that were hidden there, and he could not find them. So he humiliates her in public. He humiliates her in front of the staff and all sorts of things in order to make her continually think she's forgetting things, she's stealing things, she's misplacing things, and she starts to question her own sanity. Fortunately, there's a man who notices the abuse and sees her while her abusive husband's out and lets her know that, no, she is not the one to blame. She's being abused. It's a psychological game. So this is all gaslighting. Anyone daring to express a different opinion will find themselves a target of malicious slurs and smear tactics. South African whites in particular are being gaslighted. They are in many cases in what you could call a Stockholm syndrome. And many are apologizing for imagined offenses. And by the screaming and the shouting and so on, especially on university campuses, now you can see with males, all men are trash, and we've dealt with that. In an argument, the best form of argument is to refute the central point explicitly. You can also refutation, find the mistakes and explain why it's mistaken using their quotes. This is what was said, but it's wrong because of this and that. Counter-argument, contradicting it and then backing it up with reasoned supporting evidence. Or just contradiction. Now, this is not great. If you've got short time, you know, yes, it is. No, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. You did. No, it didn't. Yes, you did. You know. Or responding to tone. I don't like your tone. You know, forget the argument. Or ad hominem, attacking the authority of the person. You're a racist, homophobic bigot. Or you can go down to name calling. You're just an idiot, which that's the lowest form of argument. So we should try and have our arguments at the top part here where we're using facts and reason and so on. But unfortunately, most of what's going on university campuses and in the media is on this level, name-calling and honman. There's a whole lot of logical fallacies where you present a false dilemma. Well, it's either this or it's that. Well, what about if there's a third or fourth option? You know, why is it just those two? Equivocation means to avoid the main point. Poisoning the well, we'll get to. Cause and effect, ad hominem, attacking the person. Attacking the person in no way proves your point. And then circular reasoning and red herrings suddenly going down some rabbit trail has got nothing to do with it. Or straw man argument. Are you saying this and that? Well, no. But they're putting up a whole straw man argument. They're knocking it down. That's easy. And moving the goalpost, they regularly do it. The moment that you prove this, they don't acknowledge, oh, sorry, I was wrong on it. They've suddenly got another thing, and then they keep moving that. And so on. There's no end of bad logical fallacies. The issue focused on is seldom the real concern. They don't actually care about the issue. The motivation is normally just to further the revolution by discrediting all resistance. Like this poor girl up on university campus, Zizi, who got her office trashed and she was forced to resign from being deputy chairman of the Student Representative Council because she posted on a personal, private social media that God have mercy on us, we're normalizing sin, speaking about the legalization of homosexual marriage. And for this, she was demonized until the university campus suspends her, removes her. They don't deal with the people who tampered, destroyed, attacked, vilified, threatened. They deal with the victim. As Socrates famously declared, when the debate is lost, slander becomes the tool of the loser. In fact, Margaret Thatcher would often say this in Parliament, thank you for proving me right. Because now that you've resorted to ad hominem attacks, slander, you've proved you don't have an argument. Because if you had an argument, you'd use it. Those who resort to ad hominem arguments reveal they're unable to deal with the issue at hand without resorting to name-calling and character assassination against their opponent. And sadly, this is the EFF all over the place. They're everything for free party. All it can do is attack people's intentions and credibility and name call. That doesn't deal with anything. Everything is designed to undermine the strength of the targeted enemy through subversion and slander. Your argument didn't address my own, but nice try. You know, the straw man arguments are frequently used to weaken the resistance of the targeted individuals or groups. For example, you may have many reasons why you like the old South African flag, but they won't say, you only want this flag up because you're a racist and you're doing this as a hate crime. And, no, that's not the motive. But personally, I think the new South African flag is the flag of mass murder, racism, and abuse. Just look how many babies have been killed under this new South African flag. Anyway, I don't like the new South African flag because of all the terrible things being done under it, like legalizing abortion, pornography, blasphemy, and so on. So now suddenly you want to make my old South African flag where the Bible was read in schools and given to soldiers and where blasphemy was illegal and babies were protected from abortion. You want to say that's a hate crime? How about we stop trying to put motives on other people and just respect different people's views? Well, that's a radical thought. They seek to weaponize words. And there's some words that are so powerful. I'm told that in Europe today, the average European would rather be stabbed or raped than called a racist. Now, how's that for weaponizing a word? Or, take Psalm 55, verse 21. The words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but war was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet they were drawn swords. A deceptive, lying person is far more dangerous. It says, you know, the kisses of an enemy are deceitful, but the wounds of a friend can be a blessing. Of course, you can see the media is poisoning the well of justice by using sensationalism. And all too often don't we see that. How instead of a rational discussion of the subject, they want to poison the well. And you see this in a lot of social issues. And then they call free speech hate speech. Liberals used to believe that free speech was essential and censorship was bad. But now that they've got power, they want to demonize and make illegal any criticism or contradiction of their own views. They're a bunch of inquisitions. This is actual, handed around by British police. Is your child a far right-wing extremist? Look for the warning signs. Aversion to drugs, aversion to alcohol, aversion to pornography. Interest in physical fitness. Interest in mental well-being. I mean, gee, now they're talking about my son like Calvin. Interest in physical fitness. Growing collection of classical literature. Monogamy. Desire to marry. Be a father and mother. Increased time spent outdoors or in nature. Appreciation of nature, history, and culture. Like anyone who comes to the Reformation Society. Disdain for modernism and postmodernism. Far right-wing extremist. Notice there's no such thing as just right-wing. They're always far right. Have you ever heard of any far left group? But this is the kind of idiocy. How on earth is this a sign of warning signs, aversion to drugs, alcohol, and pornography? I mean, these look like the things we should be, actually. That's the Marxists seek to silence opposition by accusing anyone who dares to introduce facts and reason into the discussion. And, of course, Justin Trudeau has got to be one of the worst presidents or prime ministers in the entire Western world. What a low-life piece of rubbish he is. And so, racist, anti-Semite, Nazi, Islamophobe, homophobic, bigot. I mean, these are weaponizing words where you just shout this and most people are pre-programmed to just, sorry. And it's effective. It's like they're throwing grenades at you. And the average person, if they don't have the shield of faith and the helmet of salvation, the breastplate of righteousness, many people wilt before this kind of bombardment. Political correctness is a weapon designed to silence people whose arguments cannot be refuted. What's the definition of a racist or Nazi? Someone whose arguments I can't refute. Toxic labels are designed to intimidate opponents into silence and retreat. Toxic labels, that's a very good term. The whole goal is to intimidate. So if a person, and of course the first time you come under fire, it's very nerve-wracking. I know, which is why we do just a minute and things like this for training. I remember in the SADF, one of the training exercises was for us to crawl through the mud under barbed wire, and the barbed wire was fixed, while they had a Vickers machine gun, tuck, 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 firing overhead. And, you know, the first time you hear and feel metal passing over your head, you freeze. I mean, you get paralyzed. It's a shocking thing. And they're throwing these thunder flashes around as well. And you know, when you come under fire, the noise, the flashbangs, everything else, you freeze and you just like a rabbit in the headlights in the middle of the road. The worst thing you can do, of course, standing in the middle of the road with headlights coming towards you, is to stand still. But they have to train you to endure this so that when the real thing happens, you can keep going through your drills. And so we also need to, you know, sometimes prepare one another. We used to, in our missions, be quite, you know, racist, fascist, colonial, running dog, oppressor of the proletariat and exploiter of the masses. And I mean, that's what they're going to call us. So, you know, you just get used to throwing these words around. So when the people throw it to you in a debate on university campus, you laugh at them. Because it's pathetic. As somebody's put it, racist, rather annoying, communist-inspired silencing tactic. In fact, the word racist was made up by Leon Trotsky, head of the Red Army, mass murderer supreme, in 1927 to browbeat any dissenter of the communist ideology. Because if you opposed communism, you're obviously an anti-Semite. Obviously. I mean, why else would you oppose communism? You're an anti-Semite. And so this was the way how they used the word. Racist is a term invented by the Communist Party in the Soviet Union to silence dissent. And I don't think it's evolved much better since then. Quoting again from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, a decline in courage may be the most striking feature that an outside observer notices in the West today. The West has lost its civic courage. We no longer have courageous leaders. We've got cowards up there. Well, with the exception of Donald Trump. Such a decline in courage is particularly noticeable amongst the ruling and intellectual elite, causing an impression of a loss of courage by the entire society. You know, when we had a leader like Ian Smith in Rhodesia, who had fought for 6 years in the Royal Rhodesian Air Force, who'd been shot down twice, who'd been behind enemy lines for 5 months in Italy, who'd crossed the Alps in his socks because he couldn't put his boots on after one night and his boots had frozen solid. And a man of that kind of courage, he didn't bother with bodyguards and all that sort of thing. And, Ian Smith was fearless. You could respect a man like that. You could respect a person like P.W. Boerter. Real man. I think of people like Jonas Savimbi, who would be in the field walking with his men, fighting the communists, and go, yeah, you can respect people like that. We had some toughies. Ronald Reagan was a brave man. He got shot. He was making jokes on the operating table before they put him under. He didn't stop being out in public. He didn't let the danger to himself make him. In fact, he got more anti-communist. He was more devoted to fighting against Marxism after the attempt to assassinate him and so on. Now, there were leaders like that. Margaret Thatcher, even after her room being blown up in the middle of the Brighton Conservative Party rally, she continued. She didn't take time off or need to get her nerves settled. She is right back into the work. Now, you have some people who've got courage, and when the leader shows courage, the other people can show courage. But when you've got cowards in government, I'm afraid it goes through the whole of society, or cowards in the church pulpits even. Have you heard of the Gramsci strategy or the Frankfurt School of Cultural Marxism, the Frankfurt School? They used the cultural strategy of the Gramsci strategy, known as the Turmut strategy. Now, who the Frankfurt School? Frankfurt School, a bunch of communists who were in Frankfurt, Germany under the Weimar Republic, who fled when nationalists took over and went to America and took over Harvard and Hollywood and so on. And the Frankfurt School were hardcore Marxists, like Herbert Marcuse, who said you must use swearing as weapons, like grenades, against the bourgeois and against Christians, especially swearing, introduced into all areas. These are just some of the lowlifes of them. Like George Lucas, who's one of the top communists, he really made major impact. But amongst them was the founder of the Communist Party in Italy, Antonio Gramsci. And he devised what he called the Turmut strategy, which we call the Gramsci strategy. Now, you know, termites can be very, very, very destructive. In fact, he wanted to eat out the heart of every pillar of Western civilization until an entire edifice rots and collapses. Think of how termites can eat through wooden. If you don't treat the wood, dip it in, all these things, the termites can eat through. In fact, I'd lie, how many years I've spent lying under thatched roofs and mud huts, and you can feel all night the what's falling down. It's not dust. It's the termites eating their way through the thatch, and the bits and pieces that don't come in their mouth fall down you. So you've got this endless falling of while they're eating their way through everything. And of course, they're eating the wood out too. Well, Gramsci said they can paint, they can do what they want, but one day the entire structure is going to collapse because we're going to eat out the heart of Western civilization, and the entire rotten edifice collapses. What he called the long march to the institutions of the West. So the main aims of the Frankfurt School, who started in Germany but fled in 1933 when their enemies, the nationalists, got in power and went to America, the creation of racism offences, of course, total Trotskyite idea, continual change to create confusion, teaching of sex and homosexuality to children, undermining of, I mean, that used to be a crime. Right? It's child abuse. Now it's child abuse not to. The undermining of schools and teacher authority, huge immigration to destroy identity, promotion of obsessive drinking, emptying of churches. Think how they've glamorized excessive drinking in the movies and so on. Emptying of churches, all an unaccountable and unreliable legal system with bias towards victims of crime, against bias against the victims of crime, bias towards the criminals. Dependency on a state or state benefits. Think welfare, food stamps. Control and dumbing down of the media. Gee, talk about. You know, when you think that Shakespeare used to be popular entertainment, and Jane Austen and Dickens used to be popular entertainment, and you think of the shallow, superficial, and vulgar stuff today. Encouraging a breakdown of the family, abolishing difference in education of boys and girls, declaring women to be oppressed and men as oppressors. Recognize any of these? Okay. Their goal is the secularization of society. This is from atheist.net. Put Christianity in a trash can. No Christianity. Or to sideline Christianity. Deal with all issues without reference to the Bible. I remember my daughter Andrea asking me at one point, why does Barney never talk about Jesus? Remember Barney, the purple dinosaur? And she was probably four at the time. I said, because Barney's a humanist. What's a humanist? I'd explain about that. Next thing I remember, Andrea going up to Daniela, who wasn't even two yet. Daniela, stop watching Barney! He's a humanist!
to the other country.
But Bill Crosby Show, classic humanist. Bill Crosby, nice man, lovely family, perfect family, all without God. Solve all their problems, no Bible, no church, no God, no prayer. And so the Bill Crosby Show was a classic example of a humanist society, to secularize society. Of course, we now know that he wasn't quite as nice as they were making out, but save the planet, drop the Bible into the trash can. These are stickers they bring out. Of course, burning crosses, going to hell and proud. That's the whole theme of this march. And from the colors, I'm getting the impression LGBTQRS and so on. If Jesus returns, kill him again. Undojesus.org. And what's he got? Atheist.net, drop Christianity in trash can. There are people who actually think like that. Well, this is all part of the Gramsci strategy. Oh, by the way, when Bill Clinton became president of the United States, 1993, he was asked, who is your mentor? He said, Antonio Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci, the man who started the Gramsci strategy, founder of the Communist Party USA, one of the top persons in the Frankfurt School, and that's who this character is, who Clinton identified with. So Marxists identify five primary culture-transforming institutions for infiltration and subversion. And he said, popular schooling should be placed under control of the great workers' unions. The problem of education is the most important class problem. Why was it a problem? Because at that time, all schools were run by churches, missions, Christians, parents, homeschoolers. What a nightmare for poor Marxists. Education, entertainment, news media, and it's easy to twist the news. Just think of the difference between a zoom lens and a broad, a wide-angle lens. January 2015, remember this? There were journalists, blasphemous journalists, Charlie Hebdo, murdered by Muslim jihadists in Paris. And so 26 leaders of the world led a march of over 2 million people through the streets of Paris. And I don't know what you thought when I saw this. I thought, what a security nightmare. How did they secure... I mean, Angela Merkel, Holland, Netanyahu, and a whole bunch of others. I mean, this is a mega security nightmare until you see the broad, wide-angle picture. They weren't leading 2 million people through the streets of Paris at all. There might have been 2 million people in the streets of Paris, but they weren't leading them. This is a controlled photo op. Look at all the security people around. This is a selected group to give a complete false impression. Or take this when Barack Hussein Obama in 2013 visited Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Now, notice the journalist crouched down here to give the impression that here's this fearless American president walking out in the crowd just shaking hands. But now look at the big picture. They're all wearing the same hats. They're all wearing the same uniforms. They've all got the same kind of flags. Tanzanian American, Tanzanian American. Here's the security all behind. And security here, security there. But this is a photo op. This is a total photo op designed to deceive. It's that easy. Education, entertainment, news media, and religious institutions and political institutions. These are the five culture-carrying, culture-transforming institutions. 2 Chronicles 19 verse 2 says, should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Therefore, the wrath of the Lord is upon you. The Marxists identify stages of operation for ideological subversion. Demoralization, destabilization, crisis, and normalization. Demoralization, you must educate an entire generation in Marxist ideology. Demoralize them. Destabilize, you've got destabilized economy, the foreign relations, and defense systems. Crisis, violent change of power, structure, and economy. Normalization, followed by a period of stability to calm people down before the next. You know, like the hammer. Hammer comes down. Thesis. Hammer comes back. Antithesis. Hammer comes down again. Thesis. Back. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. This is the Marxist dialectic. 2 steps forward, 1 step back. 2 steps forward, 1 step back. You've got to relieve the pressure. The hammer coming back is part of the process of driving in the nail. This is Marxist dialectic, Hegelian, actually. So here's a ex-KGB defector, Yuri Bezmenov, who in 1984 said the highest art of warfare is not to fight at all, but to subvert everything of value in the country of your enemy until such a time the perception of reality of your enemy is screwed up to such an extent he does not perceive you as an enemy. You can take your enemy without a shot being fired. How do they do this? Well, demoralization takes 15 to 20 years, they say. They've got it in religion, politicized, commercialized, and turned to entertainment, which is a death wish for religion. Education, permissiveness, and relativity, everything's relative, leading to ignorance. Media, monopolize, manipulate, discredit, deal with non-issues, no jokes. Result, uninformed myopia. Culture, false heroes, false role models, addictive fads, the mass media. Structure, break down law and order, make it legislative, not moral. So people mistrust justice. You know, like the same court that said, it's okay to kill babies, but you can't spank your kids. You can kill them through abortion, but you can't spank them. Kill a boy, kill a farmer, not hate speech. Also, in fact, that's hate speech. Yeah? So how can you even trust the legislative system? Social relations, rights versus response. I demand my rights instead of being concerned about my responsibilities. Less individual response. Security, intelligence, police, military, leave the people defenseless. Internal politics, party antagonisms, disunity, foreign, isolation, life, break up the family, no loyalty except to the state. Health, sports, Medicare, junk food, enfeebled masses, no jokes. Race, lower the uppers, genetics versus environment. Not too sure what that means. Anyone understand what they're talking about there? Interesting. Population.
Class,
sorry?
Class.
Could be. But Bible? Population. Deland the people. Yep. Urbanize. We, in my lifetime, moved to a situation where the majority of people through all of history had been more rural than urban. In my lifetime, they announced more people are now urbanized than in the rural areas. That's actually disastrous for the family and so on. Unions versus society, victimization. So this is all part of the demoralization process. And you can see it takes communists about 20 years to do this, which is why the first phase of the revolution, the second phase of the revolution, normally is about 14 to 20 years later. Then they need distraction, smoke screens and distractions. Sometimes they deal with race, sometimes they deal with celebrities, sometimes they deal with feel-good stories, sometimes gay rights, sometimes abortion or whatever, or accident, tragedy stories. All of this is distraction. They're not telling you what's really happening in the world or what matters. But this is essential to provide a smokescreen behind which Marxist subversives can destroy everything that could be a strength in a congregation, in a community, or in a country targeted. Distractions. Gee, have we ever had such a distracted society? Just think of all the screens. And sports. To think that at one time, 2 billion people on the planet were all watching World Cup soccer. 1 billion for rugby World Cup, 2 billion for soccer World Cup. That's just extraordinary. Or did it actually reach 3 billion at one stage? It was just phenomenal to think you could know what everyone in the world is thinking. You could, what they're thinking about and how they're thinking. You could basically have 2 billion people thinking about and focusing on the same thing at the same time. How's that for power? And of course, many people, I just think of the South Africans in 1995 going absolutely berserk because we won the World Cup soccer. Yeah, okay, we had betrayed our country into the hands of Marxists to kind of kill our babies and abuse our grandkids, but, you know, we won the World Cup ball game. And that kind of distraction. Confuse, divide, and conquer. If a people can be confused, they can be divided, which makes it easy to defeat them. Hence, Marxists aim at disinformation, division and defeat for any country targeted. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. And the second phrase of this is corrupt and conquer. Degenerate entertainment, defiled art, decadent culture are part of a strategy of cultural Marxists to rot the soul of a nation. Again, quoting from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the strength or weakness of a society depends more on the level of its spiritual life than on its level of industrialization. Neither market economy nor even a general abundance constitute the crowning achievement of human life. If a nation's spiritual enemies' energies have been exhausted, it will not be saved from collapse, not even by the most perfect government structure or by any industrial development. A tree with a rotten core cannot stand. Our spiritual, moral heart is more important than everything else. And the goal of the parents is to protect their children, that they can grow up to appreciate the beautiful. This is spiritual warfare. The family is at the heart and soul of this battle. The very front line of the fight is the battle for the family. The battle for the family is the battle for the faith and for our future. But again, quoting from Solzhenitsyn, modern society is hypnotized by socialism. Free, free, free things. I remember being outside Greenpoint Stadium when the ANC had their rally and we were there doing an outreach. And they came running out there saying, free, free, free. I said, what's free? Everything's free, free. What's free? Food, meat, drink. And we were given free drinks. I was given a free ANC t-shirt. I mean, it was free, all sorts of things. People just running. People were running out of there. They hadn't even started the speeches with boxes and crates of unopened bottles of things and running the things in their heads. They'd gotten free transport to get in, trains, buses to bus them in there. And they knew there were a lot of free things. And people came to fill the stage. But many were going home with the free things already in their head, and they hadn't even started the speeches yet. And after telling the people, no alcohol allowed to be consumed here, they then opened up champagne and drank champagne up front. So, there's so much nonsense, but modern society is hypnotized by socialism. It's prevented by socialism from seeing the mortal danger it's in. One of the greatest dangers of all is you have lost all sense of danger. Solzhenitsyn speaking to the West. You cannot even see where the danger is coming from as it moves swiftly towards you. Socialism of any type leads to a total destruction of the human spirit. Why? To offer people free things is to destroy their Christian work ethic, to destroy their ethics, their morals. It's wrong. To destroy people, you must first sever their roots, your knowledge of history. In keeping silent about evil, in burying it so deep within us that no sign of it appears on the surface, we're implanting evil. And it will rise up a thousandfold in the future. When we neither punish nor reproach evildoers, we're ripping the foundations of justice from beneath new generations. In our country, the lie is not just a moral category, it's the pillar of the state. The timid civilized world has found nothing with which to oppose the sudden revival of barefaced barbarity other than concessions and smiles. Does anyone remember one of the new Batman films, Dark Knight, is it? Where Harvey Dent was made out to be a great hero. He is the evil man. He is bad. He was... But Batman, to make the city feel better about district attorney, he took the blame and let the people hero worship Harvey Dent. But as the society started to worship this false image of this great man, the whole of society got corrupted. Anyone remember that particular film? I only saw it once, but have I got it right? Harvey Dent, yeah. So on. But I think that's exactly what the world's done. It's made heroes of criminals like Stalin and Winston Churchill and Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Mandela and Martin Luther King, Mugabe now. You worship evil, you're going to become evil. Marxists employ double standards to enable them to always play the victim. They always, even when they're attacking you, and they demonize the opponents of Marxism. Don't know if you've ever talked to people who only have slogans in their heads. Along with demonizing their opponents, Marxists seem to promote hero worship of the idols of the New World Order, like Vladimir Lenin in the tomb in Moscow. But, you know, on the other side of the mausoleum of Lenin, there's Christ, there's the St. Basil's Church. See, here's where the Politburo, head of the Communist Party, stand above Lenin's bones, symbolically seeing the Red Army marching past. Here it is. This is a May Day Marxist, Satanist celebration. But on the other side, at St. Basil's Cathedral, on Easter Sunday, the people chant, where is he? He is not here. Where is he? He is not here. Where is he? He is not here. Christ is risen. And the entire congregation resounds, Christ is risen indeed. And this is the difference. Communism worships a dead God. Their idol is dead. Our God is alive forevermore. And all these idols of Marx got toppled. Thousands of these idols of Marx and Lenin got toppled in 1989 through to 1991, 92. Even as far as Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, It brought down this massive idol of Lenin. Who will rise up for me against the evildoers? Who will make a stand for me against the workers of iniquity? So, any questions? Any comments?
After watching these pictures, I had this thing coming to me. You say that it's not good to remove statues when it comes to history. It's good to preserve the history of the place and
Yes. Something.
But then removing all the...
Okay. No, I understand what you're saying. So history. We certainly should respect history, and I'm not saying that every last statue of Lenin should be taken down. It's not a bad idea to keep one up there, but they had 32,000 statues of Lenin in the Soviet Union. So taking down most of these idols was a good idea, because that's idolatry. It's like in the Reformation. The Reformation, they took down statues of Mary. Now, you can go into some museums there, and you can see that this is what the statues of Mary and of the saints look like, and the statue of the Pope and so on. But so you don't want to totally destroy the history, but the Marxists didn't know when to stop. I mean, you don't need 30-something thousand statues of one creep. So that was idolatry. And again, some people have accused the reformers of being, what do they call them? Iconoclasts for smashing statues. But what they were doing is they were fighting idolatry. So I think there's a big difference between removing an idol and trying to destroy history. But again, I mean, in this country, how many statues of Queen Victoria do we have? I mean, I know of about two. There's one in Port Elizabeth. There's one. There we go. So there are a few. But I mean, it's not like we've got thousands of those statues. There might be, I don't know, are there 100 statues of Queen Victoria in all of Africa? I'm not sure. But I don't think there's more than about four or five probably in South Africa. And, you know, to have a bit of a reminder, Queen Victoria was around. That's not bad. But, you know, if they were all over the place, like Ceausescu's pictures were in every single home and building and church in all of Romania. So you can imagine they burnt a lot of them. You can go to the museum. They've got a few of the pictures of Ceausescu and what they had there. But so it's the difference between trying to destroy history and remove the symbols of your idolatrous false religion that they were forced to worship. It could be a fine line. You've got to be careful that we don't destroy history even while we fight idolatry. But good point to bring up. Other questions or comments? These are some of the great tools that we've got for fighting against the propaganda of the commies. Yes.
The Frankfurt School was put in charge of organizing the syllabi for new schools and universities in Germany after the war by the Allies.
Ah.
So that now the children are totally...
Yes, they called it denazification. In fact, all they were doing was communizing and socializing, secularizing. It's terrible because Germany and Britain, before the Second World War, had about a 50% odd church attendance rate, average, every Sunday. And today, Britain's about 4%, Germany's about 5%. Just shocking. It just shows the result of the... Now, before the First World War, 82% of Europe was in church every Sunday, on average, the whole of Europe. End of the beginning of the Second World War, it was around 40%. Now it's down to the 4%, 5%. So it just shows you the de-Christianization of Europe that's followed these hideous, hideous bankers' wars, as Stephen Medford Goodson called them.
You know, are there any countries that have been infiltrated by the communists?
No, I'm sure all have been infiltrated to some extent because Hollywood alone has done it. But it's obviously would be differing in degrees. At this moment, I don't know that there's one true, serious Christian country on the planet where you can say this country is a Christian country in a meaningful sense. It's shocking, whereas in 1910, the world was dominated by Christian countries. So it's very important for us to mobilize people to care for the persecuted church. And of course, coming up second Sunday, November, 10th November is International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. Any other comments?
Just the I'm assuming it was a joke on the warning signs of if your child is far right.
I'm sorry.
I almost can't take it seriously.
I'm sorry. It looked like a joke. It looked like a joke to me, but that was actually passed around in Britain.
Recently, they handed out similar ones to British soldiers.
Yeah.
So it's not a joke.
It actually isn't a joke. You would swear it's a joke. It looks like a joke to me, but I'm told by my friends in Britain that's been passed around in Britain. Social workers, police, and so on. These are signs of far right wing extremists. No, it. I agree. It looks like a complete and utter joke. Yeah. I don't think these liberals can see just how stupid their actions are. But anyway, I'm afraid as I went through it, I thought, okay, we're ticking all these boxes here. really. I've got a tremendous classical book collection. Really love being out in nature. In fact, I'm never happier than when I'm out in a game reserve up a mountain, which obviously is a sign of being a right-wing extremist, yes.
Why does being a nature lover make you a far right? It has nothing to do with anything political.
Because if you were a sane person, you'd be in a discotheque, a bar, brothel, you know, smoke all in your eyes and can't see anything because of all the strobe lights and stuff like that. That's living. Not climbing mountains and going to game reserves and farming. You know. So from their minds, so I, for example, asked somebody who had always been, who had been drug addict for years and years, I said, what did you think of when you were doing drugs and for that matter, tattoos and so on. He said, Peter, to be honest, we always thought people like you were stupid because you're missing out on all the fun and the excitement and the highs of the drugs and why don't you have any tattoos anymore? You know, what's wrong with you? So he said, now he's against it, of course, now he's converted, but at the time, he said, drugs and tattoos were life. But people like you were like dead. I mean, what are you even alive for? So from their perspective, I know it looks absolutely insane to us, but they'd probably diagnose all of us here as having some kind of mental problem because we don't see the attractiveness of all the sin.
It's not cool to be healthy. It's not cool to do that.
No.
Also, if you, discos and drugs and that's part of the globalist thing. That's borderless, you know. But if you like nature, then you're cultivating a love of your country, your patriotism, etc.
Yeah.
Blood and soil and
duty, God, country, honor, faith, family. You know, I mean, these are swear words to these New World Order characters. But yeah, it really did seem like a joke. Yes, I to really be persuaded that this was actually so, sent through to me from friends in Britain. And I said, oh, come on. I mean, this has got to be a joke. And they showed me on the websites, the connections. Sadly, this is what they're circulating to, what do you call them, social workers and police.
You should just add that our life belongs to the bank because we're in debt by the bank. No, if the bank said jump, you ask how high. So that's giving loans out and things like that.
Yes, if you want to get a feel of the banks, it's a fictionalized film, but still, The International is one that just shows how you control the debt, you control everything. It's all about control.
It's crazy with the signs of atheism, for example, the signs, if Jesus comes, like, kill him again and things. Most of, like, their signs is throwing the cross or throwing the Bible. They don't speak about Islam or any other religion.
Yes.
It shows that they're clearly against Christianity. It's not against other religions at all.
Yeah. I mean, to me, before I was converted, I looked at the religious people who walked to church and I thought, what's wrong with them? You know, why are they doing this? Why don't they want to sleep in on Sunday and things like that? So, but the moment I got converted, I looked back and I felt like I hadn't really been living. I've been missing just about everything of importance. And, you know, it's like I was deaf, dumb, blind, and dead in so many parts of my life. So being regenerate made me alive. And discipleship and sanctification makes you more alive and more healthy. Why would you not want health and life? But today, holy is like a four-letter word. You use the word holy and it's like you've sworn. They really hate that. Even in some churches, which is terrible, sad. In theological colleges even more. I was just out at Stellenbosch Theological Seminary today and I was horrified, just horrified at what's going on there. What a mess. And outside they've got the monument to John Murray, and Hofmeyr, who established it, and also a memorial to Andrew Murray and Nietling. And these are leaders in the revival, in the 1860 revival. Just think, what would they think of the Quirk School now? They've got a dean who a few years ago said, theology has nothing to do with God, it's got everything to do with man.
Maybe it's a demon, not a dean. It's not a seminary, it's a seminary.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we've got sociology. We've got anthropology. Anthropology is about man. Theology is about theos, about God. Yeah. But anyway, this is the kind of things that are going on there. So, other comments? There's no doubt our seminaries have been infiltrated. But the Marxists have been planning to infiltrate the seminaries since the 1920s, and they've done a very good job. So, if you are going to go into any match, like, okay, just a week ago we were doing sword fighting tournament. You study your opponent. You see their tactics. You see their strengths and weaknesses, how they react and how they... Because you've got no chance to win a sword fight unless you know your opponent. Now, if you're going into a game, you know that how the Germans won the last World Cup soccer, or the one in 2014, how they studied, and they had a plan, and how they worked like a team... But they were just so well planned. By studying, they knew all the other players, they knew all their moves, they knew everything about the different teams that they're going to play, and they'd worked out all the different... This is how you win. You study the opponent. How can we as Christians win if we don't understand Islam, understand communism, understand secular humanism, and their agenda? Because that's who we're up against. And they are winning our young people, turning pastors, turning churches. We've now got prominent religious leaders abandoning the faith and so on, and their wives and whatever else. So how's this happening? Well, if we don't study the game plan of the enemy, we'll be surprised time and again. So it makes sense to me that, and that's why our library, unlike a bookshop, has got a lot of bad books too. You know, we've got the Quran and the Marxist Manifesto and Book of Mormon on, because we've got to understand the way the socialists and the enemies think, because we've got to counter them. Now, that's the library. In the bookshop, we shouldn't stock anything in the bookshop we can't recommend. Shouldn't. Some might slip in here and there, but generally it's books we've read or authors we know or publishers we trust, or it shouldn't be there. But a library is different, because we've got to study the other side. And so we'll even have Darwin's Origin of Species here and so on. preservation of favored races through natural selection, to use its full title. Any other comments, observations?
How is it possible that people like Mandela, Winston Churchill, Martin Luther King, all those names we know, become icons if they haven't... Yeah.
Well,
if we know the truth.
Media. Okay, so just take South Africa, our own experience in our lifetime. The facts are Nelson Mandela beats his first wife, was involved in adulterous relationships, was carrying on with Winnie Mandela while he was meant to be married to his earlier wife, who had police restraining orders against Winnie, because she'd have to flee in a nightgown to neighbours because her husband would be beating her. He would deal with Nelson Mandela when he is involved in arguments as a young man. He looked very gracious later after years in prison. But if there's disagreement, he'd get up and he'd be punching people in the face in their ANC Politburo and Communist Party Politburo. He was a violent man. And even when he was in the lead up to being president, there's a video of him singing Kill the Whites at a funeral with his fist, kill them all and so on. And when he spoke in English, he spoke very fair and reasonable. When he spoke in Xhosa, it was often, kill them all and so on. And if you didn't know Xhosa, you wouldn't know the full message. But by ignoring the bad, by focusing on the good, by exaggerating the good, by using a zoom lens instead of a wide-angle lens, people have come to see Nelson Mandela as the father of the nation, a wonderful person. One time I picked up my daughter Andrea from preschool. She's probably only 5 at the time, and she said, today I learned about this wonderful Christian who's locked up in prison. Oh, Richard von Brandt. No, that wasn't his name. And went through a few things. He's on an island off Cape Town. Said Nelson Mandela. Yes, that's... She isn't a Christian preschooler. That was not a Christian. And what our teacher said, and so, like, I'm trusting my daughter in the hands of a Christian teacher who's teaching her lies. But now we're going back to mid-1990s. But the lies just increased. And, you know, part of it is you want to earn brownie points, you want to get the applause, you want people to like you, you don't want to say something controversial, and also you don't want to be accused of being racist and so on, and so on and on. So, as several of you have heard several times before, but just classic example, a good friend of mine, Chancellor of Cornerstone University, just across the road at the Common Ground facility, they were having their graduation. And I was there to do an article on this Cornerstone College as a Christian college. So I had a clipboard, and I'm sitting there with a pen in hand for 3 hours. No responsibilities, just in the back row, take notes. Not one quote from Jesus Christ, any of the apostles, any of the reformers or missionaries, not, they didn't quote from the Apostle Peter, Andrew Murray, David Livingston, nothing. Luther, who did they quote from? It's all Martin Luther King Jr., Nelson Mandela, Voltaire, Gandhi, for goodness sakes. And it just carried on and on. At the end, the Chancellor ends off with, in the words of Nelson Mandela's character in the Invictus film, I charge you. And these are the final words after 3 hours service. You are the master of your fate. You are the captains of your soul. Which, Invictus, is an atheist poem written by an antichrist, pagan, against God. The full quote is, to whatever gods there are, I declare, I am the captain of my fate, I am the master of my soul. And it even says earlier, it matters not how straight the gate. What's the gate that's straight? Jesus is the gate. It matters not how charged with punishments the scroll. What scroll is charged with punishments? The Bible. To whatever gods there are, I declare, I am the master of my fate, I am the captain of my soul. Now this, the last part of it's quoted there by him. So, after everyone had left, I walked up and said, Michael, you do know that Martin Luther King Jr. is a sexual deviant, pervert, blasphemer, perjurer. He wasn't even a doctor or a reverend. He says, yes. I said, then why did you quote him? He said, Peter, if I don't quote from Martin Luther King, people think I'm a racist. This is how these lies are perpetrated. You've got people who would rather be raped or stabbed than called a racist. And so this is the whole tactic. So you've gotten lots of people who don't even believe it, teaching it. Now, the kids don't know that they don't believe it, so, but the kids believe it because they don't know that this person's just lying. They trusted this pastor, this teacher, this parent. And to make people feel good, like, you know, Harvey Dent was a wonderful, honorable man. Meanwhile, he is the villain. And you just get a whole society to believe a lie. Like at the end of the Second World War, people didn't want to think that we've saved the Soviet Union and betrayed hundreds of millions of people behind the Iron Curtain into the hands of the most godless antichrist pagan who's butchering them. So they had to come out with, you know, we've just saved the world, we've saved civilization. And of course, you want to believe that. I mean, you want to believe the good guys won. So they just had the people believe the lie over and over. You know, other side was so bad, they were total demons, everything did was terrible. You know, our guys never did anything wrong. They were just so honorable and decent. And you want to believe that. I mean, sure. But what's the next step? And the next step? And the next step? And now, if you want to say, why are we importing Muslims who hate Christ and so on into England? You're a Nazi! How can you even say that? You know, and, okay. And then more, and then, but, you know, they're killing people and they're burning and blowing up our tubes. Racist, Nazi, anti-Semite, anti-Islamophobic bigot. And so people retreat more and they get even more quiet and they buckle down. And this is how you take over society. Lies, 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 intimidation, name-calling and so on. And this is how the communists... Communists have never won a battle. They're not good soldiers. They don't win wars. They subvert countries and they get people to hand it over to them. And then they violate their side of the treaty. If it was just up to fighting, well, they lost all of them. This is the classic thing. As Ian Smith said, we were never beaten by enemies, we were betrayed by our friends. And that's true. The ANC can crow all they like about having the struggle and so on. They didn't ever win a battle. I don't even think they won a skirmish. The only thing they could have won is a landmine exploded here and a car bomb went off there. But I mean, no battle. They couldn't face us and win. they fled. And this is the point, but that was just for show. They never put their trust in the military. They put their trust in our guys, our professors, journalists, dominies, professors, moderators, betraying the country. Not to mention the ultimate folks for our F.W. de Klerk and Pickporter, who I think did a lot of the backstabbing. But, I mean, that's how it works. So the same thing with Britain. I mean, honestly, when you start to look at Winston Churchill reading Pat Buchanan's book, it's like, how did they ever make a hero of this really immoral person? Who's even a pagan? I mean, he didn't believe in anything Christian. He used words like Christian civilization in his speeches because he needn't get elected by Christians. But in his personal views, he is as pagan as they come. That's why Winston Churchill wrote in his own biography the most terrifying sound I ever heard in my life, more terrifying than the sounds of incoming shells, was on the night I was captured by the Boers in Natal. I heard the Boers singing psalms. I thought, my God, what kind of enemies do we have? And then he put there, they have the better cause. This is his own book. The sound of the Boers singing psalms struck fear into him. Most terrifying sound of my life. This, in his book on the Afghan campaign, he speaks about, we went into that village and we killed everyone, men, women, children, we left nothing alive. It's in the 1890s in the Afghan campaign. Total war criminal. Rejoicing about, you know, we killed them all. And then after the Battle of Omdurman, 1898, outside Khartoum, how he walked around after the battle with his Mauser 762, shooting wounded Mahdi, what do they call them? The Mahdists. Things that are total war crimes. When he was Secretary of the Colonies, he drew the map to deprive the Kurds of their own country, parcel them out, this massive country between the Turks, the Iraqis, and Iranians. And when they protested, he got the Royal Air Force to drop mustard gas bombs on them. Now, if you know these facts in history, you can't idolize Winston Churchill. But Winston Churchill, but they made him out to, he was voted by Time magazine Man of the Century. And he's also been voted the greatest Briton of the 20th century and the greatest Briton of all times. And he wasn't even British. He was anti-British. Well, mother was American anyway. But all of his decisions served the cause of the Americans and the Soviets and destroyed the British Empire. He actually, more than any other single human being, destroyed the British Empire, betrayed Africa and all the rest of it, as well documented by Pat Buchanan's book on Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. I've got friends that idolize Churchill. And they want to believe it because they want to believe the whole narrative he's meant to be the hero of. But so Pat Buchanan in his book, Churchill, Hitler, and Unnecessary War, says the Churchill cult has led to the deaths of tens of millions of people in his lifetime in the Middle East. Because every enemy is Hitler. And anyone who talks some kind of reconciliation short of war is Chamberlain, and you are the new Churchill, and they've bombed the hell out of how many countries, killed how many Christians all over the Middle East, and the number of Christians in the Middle East has plummeted. We used to have 15 million Christians in the Middle East. We don't even have 10 million left now. And because of this Churchill cult, where they endlessly want to do what Churchill did, which is go into ruinous wars for no good reason in places that have nothing to do with you. And so the Churchill cult has led to a lot of the mess in the world. So, again, it's not harmless to worship a Harvey Dent. The moment you lift up the lie, you're going to impoverish and rot your whole soul. And the West has gotten rotten because we're worshiping wicked, evil, false heroes who are not heroes at all. Which is why we're trying to go back to the great heroes like Victorious Christians, Grace, since the Reformation. That's been our focus.
So how do we end this loop of uplifting all these
facts? Facts can ruin a good story. Truth does not fear investigation. And so, one video at a time, one presentation time, one book at a time, sometimes articles. But I think we've demolished a few myths over here.